Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Outspoken with White and Jordan. 100% engagement.
It's a total disrespect.
Download, stand well back, listen.
Jim White and Simon Jordan.
I don't see that view.
Outspoken with White and Jordan.
From the world's biggest sports radio station, Talk Sport.
Thanks for listening to Outspoken with White and Jordan. I'm Jim White, and today myself and Simon asked whether or not Manchester City are the best team in Europe. The phone lines lit up following Simon giving his view on City's ownership model, while Trent Alexander-Arnold's trophy dig at their rivals also came under discussion. Meantime, we talk boxing with Spencer Oliver, former UFC star Dan Hardy, and Daniel Dubois' trainer, Don Charles, as we build up to the big fight tomorrow night between Anthony Joshua and Francis Ngannou. This is Outspoken with White and Jordan. A lot to get through this morning, not least in the world of the Champions League, because we expected it. But we come to expect Manchester City to beat any opponent they get on the field of play with. Manchester City beat Copenhagen 6-2 on aggregate, and they cruise into the Champions League quarterfinals. But are they cruising to the trophy? Well, one Danish fellow by the name of Jakob Nistrup on TNT Sports certainly thinks so.
They're going to win it. They are. I think we have played a couple of or three very, very good teams, and but this is just a level up in everything, and big respect for that. I think the group we were in was very, very difficult, and we did a great job, and there was very good teams, but this is just a level up, and it's how it is.
So that was the Copenhagen manager post-match saying, yeah, we've been up close and personal with them, but looking at them, nobody can live with Manchester City. I'm inclined to agree, Simon, because the channel hopped a bit last night and saw a very indifferent performance from Real Madrid against Leipzig, although Madrid progressed.
Yeah.
But City look a class apart, don't they?
They do. And, you know, the principal idea that they will win the Champions League is one that I've alighted upon for some time now, because I think that they will. Now, of course, in knockout competitions, we've seen Manchester City be a very powerful side and lose games that you wouldn't have expected them to lose. And that's all being put under the mantra of we're not experienced in Europe, which, by the way, is a lot of old cobblers, because most of the players and managers that have managed Man City are extremely experienced in playing in European football. Now, that they are, for me, the best team in Europe. And so with that goes hand in hand, the not so much the responsibility, but the opportunity to win the Champions League back-to-back.
Yeah.
The irony of Manchester City really is the only thing that's English about them is the geography and the fan base. The rest of it isn't particularly English from the players on the field, although we've got a nice spattering of English players in the Manchester City side achieving good things in Foden and certainly John Stones and Kyle Walker, of course.
But you could say that a lot about
the Premier League. Yeah. So this argument that ultimately it's just about geography now. Once upon a time when the Spanish dominated the Champions League or the Italians dominated, it really was about indigenous clubs with indigenous players and indigenous management. It's all moved on. It's a globalised world. I expect Man City to win the Champions League unless they turn up and have a bad day. Madrid have been, in times, lucky in recent years in the Champions League, gotten through games that you wouldn't have expected them to have gotten through simply because they want to and they find a way and they have the know-how. So all of that forms part of it. But they've broken the seal, Manchester City. There's no barrier to entry anymore. They've won the Champions League. So the challenge now for European football is they might have the European football and the UEFAs of the world might have the same challenge we're going to have in the domestic Premier League, which is they're going to have a domination potentially of the Champions League by Manchester City.
Yeah.
That's not going to sit very well with them because they pride themselves on the competitivity and the jeopardy of it, albeit we've seen significant dominance from Real Madrid over the years.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, only one team in the history of the Champions League have won it back-to-back, and that's Real Madrid in 2018.
Yep.
I think it's City's time. I really do too.
I do too. I think that ultimately, as I say, they've broken the seal. The genie's out of the bottle in terms of can they win a Champions League? Of course they can win a Champions League. Of course they should have done previously. They now have. So now what they'll do, in my view, is cement things, because this is what serial, relentless, determined winners do. They don't lose their appetite. They don't run out of energy. They continue. And they continue to develop until they finish whatever they think they've got to finish.
One thing you can't fault them for, Simon, they're right to have it. They have a real pride in what they do. The people at the top are immensely proud of their Manchester City and what Manchester City stands for and what Manchester City has achieved. He was speaking very recently at a convention, and it's rare that we hear from him, but this was the chairman, Khaldun Al-Mubarak.
You keep winning with a commitment for excellence. When you wake up every day with that hunger, with that urge, and when it's consistent in the DNA and the culture of the club. One of the things I would say I'm most proud of is over this 15-year journey, what you have today in Manchester City is a DNA, a culture, that is in every person that's involved in the club. And because of that, when you win 7 Premier Leagues in the last 11 years, when you win 3 Premier Leagues in a row, the first team since 1999 to win a treble, the only other team to win a treble in England. And this year, obviously, we're going to go for hopefully the 4th Premier League in a row and maybe another treble. But that hunger, that urge to get better, to win, to constantly want to improve, never to be comfortable, never to be content. This is, I think, what makes this team and this organization special. This is what makes the 15 years, I think, a privilege. But this is why I think you see a consistency, and this is why when you look at the future, I think from our perspective, we're always looking at how to get better, how to win more, and how to constantly improve. And that's going to be how we build this legacy.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard you scoffing throughout that, but this is a freight train, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And this is the reasons why they cannot find themselves being convicted of 115 charges on any level, irrespective of the Q outrage from the Man City fans that think they're not guilty of anything. Of course, their DNA is for this club. Their pursuit of excellence and their pursuit of winning things is absolutely relentless and unnegotiable. In terms of the perspective on it, also because it's a wonderful way to keep image laundering your main focus, which is the reason why you bought Manchester City, which was to image launder and to make sure that people understand certain aspects of your culture and community through the ownership model, through a wonderful asset in Manchester City, I say Crystal Palace here, in Manchester City. So from that point of view, you can't deny. I cannot deny. I do not deny. Have never denied the excellence and the pursuit of excellence and the subsequent benefits that Manchester City fans and the area of Manchester City have gotten from this ownership
model. And I've seen that area around the Etihad. It's unbelievable what they've done. It's not a denial
to be able to go
image
to the...
Image laundering.
Absolutely. That's the ownership model. The ownership model owns this football club for one particular reason, image laundering. That's the end of the discussion, whether you think it's wrong or right. In my view, it's very clear.
The DNA is success. It's not image laundering.
The DNA of the football team, the DNA of the ownership is to make sure that they're represented through the prison of football in the best possible way they possibly can. They've got a shiny, bright, wonderful football club that's now dominating football. And with that in mind, if you look at it as purely and simply, which I do not, but if you look at it purely and simply as a football team on a football pitch, then they are a thing to behold.
But it's Todd Bowley at Chelsea doing it just for football. No, it's John W. Henry at Liverpool doing it just for football.
No, he's doing it for money.
Yeah.
He's doing it for money. There's a completely different perspective. He's a private equity guy that's bought an asset that he believes will turn into a significantly greater capital opportunity for him. John Henry makes money through the business of sport and media rights and owns significant franchises.
So they've all got their different agendas.
Sure, but there's a slightly more pure agenda about the idea that you make money and how you distribute that money and what you do with that money. Of course, we can debate about the ideas of billionaires, you know, and the concentration of wealth into certain quarters. But I find, with due respect, whether people like this or not, I find the pursuit of capitalism, as long as it's responsible capitalism, more palatable than the pursuit of laundering an image because you want to gain access to certain parts of the world and certain opportunities.
That's more palatable.
The billion-pound Chelsea spend is more palatable than what Khaldun and the rest of them have done, especially for the infrastructure around that part of Manchester and the northwest.
That's capitalism.
The money aspect of it is more palatable for you.
The palatability of it is that there's a clearer and more concise agenda behind making money than there is behind taking British assets and using them to create an opportunity to repackage yourself for the international community to look at you through a different set of eyes. And Manchester City have been utilised and used for that. Now, the beneficiaries of that, of course, have been the Man City fans, and they have every right to be proud of their football club. My opinion is my opinion, and if people don't like it, they can get on with it. That's, you know, that's the way the world lives, right? But the point is that as a thing of beauty, as a team that, to my mind, is almost going to eclipse what's ever been done before in English football, it's unarguable. Why would anyone want to argue it? I don't argue it.
This is pure and simple image laundering.
Well, the ownership of the... Yes, I would imagine that there was a desperate need for people in Saudi to want to rock over to Manchester and be involved with Manchester City and regenerate certain aspects of Manchester. No, it's part of an overall package. And they have every right to do it. And I have every right to comment on it, and people have every right to critique my commentary on it. Mm. You know, at the end of the day, do I believe that Manchester City have charges to answer for? Yes, I do. Do I believe that they'll ever be found guilty? Probably not. The Premier League are probably disappearing down a rabbit hole debating how much these sponsorships are worth rather than actually concentrating on the key issue, which is, was it equity investment or was it not? And most sensible observers think it was. So you look at it from that point of view and say, then again, on the other side of the argument, I look at it and say, Manchester City have done what? The ownership model has pumped hundreds of millions of pounds into the British economy. And the only thing that's really broken is football rules. But when you look at it and suggest that actually what it's done is capitalism gone crazy to some extent, because it's gone into English football, poured hundreds of million pounds, and the main beneficiaries have been the British Exchequer alongside Manchester City fans. But there's something about obfuscation and agendas that aren't about football and achievements through football that I don't find as palatable as I'd like to. Don't get me wrong, I don't think Todd Bowley's approach is overly palatable. I don't think it's... you've heard me on record say it's a horrible look. What an awful way to behave. Go in there and just throw cash at a wall and see how much of it can stick.
It was interesting last night that Jakob Nystrup, we heard from him earlier on, the Copenhagen head coach, said afterwards, Manchester City are as near to perfection as you could ever find in football. Khaldun Al-Mubarak, the chairman, is saying, we have built enormous success that we're very proud of, not just on the field, but off it in the northwest of the country as well. But Simon, you're not having it. You say, as far as you're concerned, it's all about image. It's all about image laundering.
The ownership is, yes. I don't think the football team is. I think Pep Guardiola is the best manager in world football. I think they're on a par with Jurgen Klopp. I think if Jurgen Klopp had some of the resources that he had at Manchester City, I think Jurgen Klopp would have done the same things. So I think you've got an elite manager, you've got elite players, an elite football team, and a determination to win. You've got great infrastructure behind them.
Yeah.
So they've got a wonderful, 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 wonderful football team that, in my view, is the best football team that potentially we could debate has ever graced the Premier League.
That was four wonderfuls. Everybody wants to have a tilt at them.
But all of that will be dismissed by me saying the ownership model, you know, concerns me and has concerned me, not because I'm xenophobic and not because I have an issue with Middle Eastern money, but because I have an issue with the principles of how sport should be utilised. I make this point repeatedly about sport being utilised for other agendas. I don't think I'm inconsistent. I make it across every point. So all of these Man City fans that want to send in some of the tripe that they're sending in now about what my agenda may or may not be are completely misunderstanding my point.
So how should sport be utilised? How should a football club be utilised?
For sport. And ultimately,
Manchester City are giving their fans the best time of their lives. What's wrong with that?
I actually don't think that sport should be utilised full stop. I actually don't think there's anything wrong with people making money from sport, because everybody else does, so why shouldn't an owner? So if a player makes a fortune out of sport, and everything in the last 25 years has been the increase in the huge benefits, the players, managers, the unions, the agency side of things. So I don't think there's any issue with people making some capital value out of sport, and it's all part and parcel of it. But when you've got certainly difficult regimes operating with certainly difficult positions in the world and certainly different parameters than we operate with, and given the fact it's an English asset, with respect, I think I'm entirely within my gift to turn around and say, I think English football clubs should represent the values of this country and not be hijacked by other people, other countries, with an idea to be able to launder what they think they want the world to look at them through.
Simon, it's an English asset that is benefiting England. And the top flight football league in England.
And there's the juxtapose. Is it?
Of course it is.
Is it? Okay.
Benefiting England.
Well, the main beneficiaries of Manchester City's success are Manchester City.
Manchester City have got everybody in the world talking about Manchester City.
And the main beneficiaries...
Football lovers worldwide are talking about
and
them.
And the main beneficiaries of Liverpool's success are Liverpool. And the main beneficiaries of any football club's success, ultimately, of course, there's benefits of association. Of course, as a result of having elite football teams, you're going to have some, like we did debated yesterday, about the benefit of Wrexham and their ownership model enhancing some of the value of the overseas rights. It's not a debate. Yes, it does. But is it a determining factor? Probably not. Was the Premier League rocking and rolling and growing at a ridiculous rate before Manchester City alighted upon huge investment and huge change of direction in their ownership? Yes, it was. So if Manchester City dropped off the face of the earth, if they got charged with 115 charges and dropped into another division, which won't happen, by the way, would that mean the Premier League would suddenly not be getting £5 billion a year? No. Would it not be still getting the same amount of eyes on the prize? No.
You see, ahead of Liverpool, Man City on Sunday, it's almost predictable, but the Liverpool side of things is coming through in terms of quotes from Trent Alexander-Arnold. Looking back in this era, although Manchester City won more titles than us and have probably been more successful, our trophies mean more to us and our fan base because of the situations at both clubs financially. How both clubs have built their teams and the manner in which we've done it probably means more to our fans.
Well, I think that's untrue.
Does he think for one moment that City's success doesn't mean as much to City's fans?
Well, that's where he's on very fragile ground. That's where he's on infertile ground. He's not in the right space. He can't possibly suggest, in any true sense of the word, that the value of Manchester City to its fans is any less than the value of...
But he's straying into your narrative.
No, he's not.
Because you're suggesting that City aren't a legacy club.
He's not straying into my narrative.
Yes, he is.
No. He's departing into a different area.
Classic club type thing.
I may well think that they're a manufactured club. I may well think...
Never mind, you've said it.
I may well think that Chelsea are too. There's no organic growth about them. They've been created by one person's will and one person's money, in the instance of Roman Abramovich for Chelsea and the instance of Sheikh Mansour for Manchester City. But he's not right... and cannot be right, and will never be right, to suggest that what it means to Man City fans is less than what it means to Liverpool fans.
So what do you say to this Manchester City fan who says this? Morning, guys. What's wrong with wanting the world to see you in a better light? Should the world still hate England because of our bloodthirsty past? He's got a point, hasn't he?
We spend our time in this country self-flagellating. We spend our entire time telling the entire world
that,
how awful
Simon.
We are.
We were allowed to change. Why can't the Middle East? Now, that middle line is a cracking line. Should the world still hate England because of our bloodthirsty past?
Well, judging by the West, judging by this Man City fan is saying. By the constant self-flagellation that we do through the Western media about what an awful country we are, we don't need anyone else to hate us because we do enough of it ourselves. The point is that I'm always in the camp of finding the balance between ensuring that an ownership model is for the betterment of the football club and, of course, themselves, because why shouldn't they be? Because ultimately, I didn't want to lose 50 million quid in Palace. It wasn't my objective to go, let me see if I could pee away significant proportions of my fortune. It was to be successful and hopefully at some point get some of the benefits of it. But there is a balance between achieving objectives through sport and what those objectives are and doing it in a certain way. And I have a degree of resistance to it, in the same way that I have resistance towards American owners coming into the Premier League and suggesting that maybe one day we'll change the direction of travel so we don't have any relegation.
The truth is, and this is the truth, isn't it? And it's hard to argue that it's not. Owners like yourself, a former owner like yourself, could no longer get anywhere near the top table because of giants like City, because of giants like the Americans coming in with seemingly endless money. You cannot get to the top table now because you're no longer eligible. You're envious.
And that's globalist. That's globalised business. And that's the reality of it. The cook, the candlestick maker and the baker that own football clubs have long since gone.
So what's your problem with that?
I don't have a problem with it. I have a problem with the manner in which sport is being utilised. There's not one single shred of envy about Manchester City. It means not a jot to me.
Except
it's a subject matter that comes up regularly.
As we head to the break now, summarise to me your thought on Manchester City. I say Manchester City to you at the moment. What do Manchester City, in your mind, conjure up in your own mind at the moment? Where they are? What are they? What are they? To me, they are a freight train that nobody can now stop.
As a football team. As a football team.
As a football club.
No, as a football team. There's two different things. As a football team, they represent unique excellence, a like of which we may have never seen before. As a football operation, I have reservations about them. I have reservations about their ability to be able to face the charges that I think they should be facing. I have reservations about their agenda and their motivations. I have reservations about those areas because I think they're reasonable reservations to have. They're not biased. They're not steeped in any resistance towards change and evolution. They're just a concern factor that I think most sensible, rational people should have.
100% engagement. Outspoken with White and Jordan.
Trent Alexander-Arnold has released the pot, saying, looking back in this era, although City won more titles than us and have been more successful than us, our trophies mean more to us. So they're dishing it out any which way they can to City and City fans. Dom's an Arsenal fan. Dom, one of many, calling 03717223344. Dom, good morning. What do you want to say in that?
Morning, boys. Hello, Jim. Hello, Simon.
Hello, morning. Dom. Good morning.
Do you know what? It's a good. I'm glad you brought this debate up, and I fully agree with Simon Jordan on all his views, but obviously Simon's slightly different on what Trent's saying. But I'll give you a view from an Arsenal fan, a big Arsenal fan. I've been going since '87, so I've been going a long time. So I've seen the ups, the highs, the lows, everything with Arsenal. Now I had this same debate a few years ago with my Chelsea mates. And it's only hit home to a few of them now. But I agree with everything that Trent says there, because Liverpool and Arsenal, if in a way, obviously they've won more than us, but in a way are very similar clubs, the way we've had to do things over the years. We've never had an owner that's like Chelsea that's put $2 billion, basically used $2 billion of his own money and not wanted any of it back. If you look at the years when Arsenal were winning titles, or even when they went on through the periods where they couldn't win the title and they started nicking the odd FA Cup here and there, that was during a period where we had to sell our best players. Liverpool have had to do that in their time. We've had to build a stadium through using our own resources. We weren't allowed to go in and buy the big players. And we've always had to, like Liverpool, we've always had to find a way, even if it was in-house or if it was doing it the hard way with players like, if you think when Arsenal last won the FA Cup, they had players like Rob Holding there, Mustafi, but they still found a way. Like Liverpool the other day with their kids, they found a way.
Dom, is it not the case, though, sorry to jump in, is it not the case that you at Arsenal and Trent at Liverpool are simply envious of this incredible consistency that Manchester City achieve?
No,
they're on a different level, Dom.
No, it's not envious, and if anything, it's a challenge to the rest of us. But it does not deny the fact that teams like Liverpool, teams like Arsenal, that have always, they've never had it on a plate. So, and Simon will back this one up. How many clubs, tell me, like when Chelsea, they've still not got a brand new stadium, but when Arsenal had to do it, if you look at what we had to do, we had to sell Robin Van Persie's, we had to sell Fabregas. Teams like Chelsea and Man City, they don't have to do things like that. So when it comes to winning things, the reason we say it means more to us because we feel we've done it the right way, the proper way, going through the hard times, having to deal with, do you know what, we ain't got a centre-forward. Do you know what, so let's use Eddie Nketiah, let's do that. Where other clubs like Chelsea, they just go, do you know what, 100 million in. Oh, it don't work? We'll get rid of that 100 million, we'll try something else. And I'll tell you what, as a fan, believe me now, It will wind up Chelsea fans and it will wind up City fans. But the facts are there. It means more to us because we're doing it the right way.
The only thing I would say to conflict that, Dom, is that Man City fans that supported their teams that went down to what is now League One and still turned out in significant numbers, I don't think we can say that it's a fair observation to suggest that just because Man City are the beneficiaries of a lottery win by having an owner that's prepared to do what he's prepared to do, that they don't have the same value of it, because they would have been the same group of fans that were watching Paul Dickhoff score a goal to win the playoffs to get them out of League One, you know, 25 years ago, where Arsenal have never had that indignation.
Dom, many good points. I want to thank you for your call and the points you made in it. Let's hear from Manchester City fan Stephen. Stephen, what do you make of all this? People chucking stones at you, right, left and centre.
Where do we begin with Simon Jordan?
I've got to tell you, Simon Jordan, you're going about your 50 million quid that you lost at Crystal Palace. Go back all that time, right to the end of your days at Crystal Palace. You've lost 50 million quid. You're facing, your boxer shorts are so tight now, you can feel it. And then an Abu Dhabi mob come in. The same Abu Dhabi mob that now own us came into you and said, I tell you what, we'll buy Crystal Palace off you and we'll give you your 50 million quid back, Simon. You're going to tell me, Simon, that you're going to turn down that deal?
You don't know what I would and wouldn't do. And I'm not entirely sure.
It's a fair question.
Stephen, if you want to attack my arguments, attack my arguments. And you know, if you're suggesting that there's a hypocrisy about my preparedness to sell to the Middle East, a Middle Eastern consortium, well, we'll never know because I wasn't in that position. But I do have some tragic things in my life, Stephen, which are principles. And I'm not a hypocrite because I stand by my principles. And it's likely that I would have grave reservations. But put me in that situation, put me to the test. I don't know. But what you guys at Man City do, what you guys at Man City do is you ignore all of the praise. All the praise that you get from people like me, and you focus on the criticism. And you want to get over this inferiority complex. You've got a wonderful side that's winning wonderful things, but there are questions about your ownership. Why don't you grow up and get over it?
No, Simon, you don't give us praise. You just praise the football team, which you can't avoid praising. They're a great football team,
indeed,
no matter what. But you do nothing else to give us any praise. You just do that as if to say, I'm being fair.
Well, what other praise should I give you then?
And go back to the question I asked you. Would you sell the football club? You know exactly what you would do.
Well, you don't know me, Stephen. So you can't make that observation any more than I know you. So you don't know. I just gave you an answer to your question about principles and morals. And of course, if you're Groucho Marx, you change your principles and morals and get a new set. But the point is that you asked me a question, I gave you an answer. You don't like my answer. And now you want to misrepresent what I've said.
No, you didn't give an answer.
I did.
Jim.
I said unlikely.
Jim, did you give him an answer?
Yeah, I did. Pay attention.
Jim.
Pay attention. Stop looking for confirmation bias and listen to what I say.
I tell you what, Stephen. Ask him the question again.
At the end of your time at Crystal Palace, when you're facing 50 million quid going down the Swanee, the Abu Dhabi mob that own us go into your ground and say, we will pay you your 50 million quid back. We want to buy Crystal Palace. We want to develop them. We want to take them on. And there's your 50 million quid. And you're going to go, well, I'm not sure about that. Tell me, what was your answer going to be?
Well, would you have spoken to them,
well,
Simon?
Depends upon the agenda of the consortium and what their motivations were and what the benefit to the football club was and what I looked at full stop. It's a hypothetical question. And of course, if you frame it within the confines of my pitiful 50 million quid that I lost and how I carp on about it, then if you frame it in that way, then it's a difficult question to answer because ultimately when you're grasping for straws, you grasp for straws.
Stephen, do you object to Simon suggesting that your owners are image laundering?
Image laundering, this is really funny. You look at the world and you look at football, and you look at Manchester City and you look at the Premier League in world situations. Do you think the Abu Dhabi mob want to launder their image using a Manchester
using
club
sport? Yeah. Using one of the most influential platforms and prisms to be able to create messaging and gain access into environments you wouldn't get to before.
Go on the streets of Mayfair and ask 1,000 people who own Manchester City, what country did they come from? And I tell you what, I think you'll get 600 to 700 people who've got no idea where they come from. They might say the Middle East in a general way. They won't know where they come from. That's a nonsense statement.
Stephen, does your football club and being a fan of it make you proud?
I am unbelievably proud of the way they've run that football club. Unbelievably proud. I think they've done a fantastic job. Yes. There are questions and they've got to give answers to the questions that are coming up.
Which they don't want to do and which they more often not don't do.
And Stephen, what do you make of Trent's comments going into this match at the weekend? Although City have won more titles than us, our trophies mean more to us and our fan base because of the situations at both clubs financially.
Well, I tell you what, my first cup final was 1976 and Dennis Stewart scored a great goal and we won it. I love that just as much as I did the Aguero moment and just as much as I love the moment last year.
Did you hear me defend Manchester City against that ridiculous assertion from Trent Alexander-Arnold that it meant more to Liverpool? Did you hear me defend your fans? Did you hear me talk about moments for you and Paul Dickoff who played for me? Do you know who my favourite player was when I grew up? Peter Barnes playing for your side. I have no bias and no agenda against Man City, but I do have concerns about your ownership model and I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, but Simon, you come from an era where you all had your belly tickled by Manchester United.
No, not true. Not true at all. I'm very happy to see teams doing well.
Let Stephen respond, Simon.
Mancini came into Manchester City and he said, I do not understand the people in this country. They go to Old Trafford, they get the belly tickled, they call Sir Alex, and then they go home after getting a 4-0 drubbing. He said, I'm here to change that, and he did change that, and people don't like it. Everybody was comfortable with Sir Alex being Sir Alex and Man United being Man United. They're not comfortable with Man City
But Mancini's a real poster boy for what's good in football, isn't he? Leaves the Italian national side to go and get some Middle Eastern money when it suits him. I'm not sure that's a good example of why we should be looking at Mancini as someone to be revered.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hard-edged, hard-nosed, hard to beat. Outspoken with White and Jordan.
We're talking boxing with Spencer Oliver. Just gone 20 past 12. Of course, all eyes, not for the first time, on Saudi Arabia tomorrow, because that's where it all seems to happen these days. AJ goes in against Francis Ngannou. The man who put Tyson Fury on the seat of his pants, but then didn't get the verdict and lost the fight. Tomorrow, AJ goes in against Ngannou, as well as a whole bunch of other fights, which we will come to. But of course, all eyes on Ngannou again. And the story in the rise of this fella is both bewildering and intriguing. I'm delighted to welcome along with Spencer, myself and Simon, former welterweight MMA fighter and PFL director of fight operations, Dan Hardy, to the show. Dan, good afternoon. Did you ever envisage that someone from your sport, Ngannou, would be playing such a major role in boxing?
You know, I honestly thought it was only a matter of time. I mean, you know, we dabbled obviously with the McGregor-Mayweather event, but this at heavyweight seems far more interesting, you know, because these guys can change the face of a fight in one punch. I'm excited. I like these crossovers. I know that you guys are, I was listening to the end of the last segment. I know you guys aren't as keen on them, but as a combat sports fan, this for me is intriguing, almost like when Muhammad Ali fought Antonio Inoki, which I'm sure we'd have all tuned in for if we would have been there.
Dan, I agree with you. Like, I don't mind these crossover fights as well in the heavyweight division, because we know what the heavyweight division brings. One shot can change it all around. We know that Francis Ngannou, his backstory, where he comes from, getting in the boxing ring, he will gamble, he'll roll the dice, and he'll take it straight to Anthony Joshua, and then we see what happens, you know. And so it is an intriguing fight. It's not like when we saw McGregor box Mayweather, because there you're just talking about levels, you know. The lighter guys, it becomes more technical, but with the heavyweights, anything can happen, and Ngannou has proved that he can hold his hands up.
Exactly. You know, he surprised all of us, including me. I thought Fury was going to pick him off around sort of the fifth or sixth round. But, you know, he held his shape. He was disciplined. He didn't bite on any feints. He had good footwork. And I thought he managed his energy very well for a guy that was making his pro boxing debut and didn't know whether he could go 10 rounds with one of the best that's ever done it. I thought he looked absolutely fantastic. And of course, you know, he didn't come out with the victory, but just the fact that he got in through the ropes and was given the opportunity from the MMA perspective was a pretty big victory. And I think he held his own. And I think going into this next one, AJ for me is a better opponent for him stylistically. And I also think that the confidence of a 10-round fighter in Ngannou is going to be more active this time around, which, and look, AJ's waking up tomorrow morning with the idea of fighting a guy that's 0-1 in professional boxing. He could fall off the biggest cliff of his career. That, for me, it alone is intriguing. I like the fact that he's taking on this challenge to make a statement to Fury. And Ngannou's the guy that he has to do it against.
Dan, what does this say through the prism of combat sports about the two disciplines? Because, you know, I spoke to Leon Edwards the other day, and I've spoken to various professional fighters about getting into the octagon. I think it's universally accepted that if a boxer walked into an octagon, he wouldn't last very long. Whereas a UFC guy going over to the boxing world is now making a swathe. So it's almost a one-way transaction that UFC, if through the prism of combat sports, is a multifaceted environment and boxing is very one-dimensional as a result.
It is, absolutely. But, you know, from a martial artist perspective, I love boxing. I always have done. Julio Cesar Chavez was one of my favorites of all time to study because he was a specialist with his hands. And of course, that is a big component of our sport. I mean, certain things do change. You know, we go from 90 degree angles in the corners in a boxing ring to 135 degrees in an octagon. So, you know, you have to be a little more subtle with your footwork in MMA, but you also have to control your feet because we don't wear boots. Like, we saw Clarissa Shields fighting in Saudi Arabia the other week, and, you know, she didn't look as clean and as tidy a striker in MMA because she was traveling into the clinch. It's a very, very different thing. And, you know, anybody that crosses over from one sport to another, regardless of whether it's MMA to boxing or vice versa, that they have my respect because, you know, they're doing it on the biggest stage
but
in the world.
But your guys can cross over. Boxing can't cross over the other way.
We James Toney tried to, of course. It didn't work out too well for him. But, you know, you've got to remember, in mixed martial arts, we're not specialists with our hands, but we are specialists with many, many other ranges of the game. Like, a lot of boxers would be completely dismantled if we just added low kicks in. Like, I could find a kickboxer right now that could dismantle some good heavyweight boxers if he was allowed to kick them in the legs. And then you add in knees and elbows, and you add in wrestling and takedowns and all the plethora of submissions that we have options. We have a lot more to learn when it comes to skills than boxers, but boxers are far more refined in one skill set. So for us to raise our game to that level of boxing is very, very difficult. As we saw with McGregor Mayweather, the point that Spence made was correct. Heavyweight is different because one punch can change a lot. And we saw that in the last fight with Ngannou. And nobody punches like Ngannou. I don't think there are many people as strong as him in the clinch as well. And I think that that's an interesting problem for boxers to try and solve.
The world's most dangerous download. Outspoken with White and Jordan. From the world's biggest sports radio station, Talk Sport.
And the three of us have become the four of us because top trainer and the trainer of Daniel Dubois, Don Charles, joins us live here in studio. Don, good afternoon to you, my friend.
Good afternoon, Jim.
Not for the first time, all eyes on Saudi. Are your eyes on Saudi? Are you as intrigued as everybody seems to be as to whether or not Ngannou can rock Anthony Joshua tomorrow over there?
Most definitely. My eyes are always on the heavyweight division. You know, we're getting treated quite regularly, you know. These fights are coming fast and furious, you know. And, yeah, obviously the fight tomorrow between Ngannou and Joshua, a very intriguing fight.
Yeah, we heard Dan Hardy, who called it for Ngannou. I think that maybe surprised Spencer. I'm not so sure about Simon. What do you think? I mean, Dan Hardy, of course, is a former MMA fighter, knows everything that goes on in that sport, but he takes his man to break down Joshua.
Well, most definitely, if you know, that's his opinion. We all have opinions, and I agree to differ. No, my opinion is that Joshua will be victorious. There are ways he has to approach the fight in order to be victorious.
Don, you know the MMA world quite well. You trained Roger Gracie as well, so he come over and started training, doing that the discipline UFC, MMA, into boxing, so you know what the transition is, you know how it's made. What did you make of Ngannou's performance against Tyson Fury? Was it that Tyson Fury underprepared, or was Ngannou better than what he's given credit for going into that fight?
Both. Right. Tyson, in my opinion, was underprepared, and Ngannou was better than we all thought. And I got it wrong. I totally got it wrong because I said that I just couldn't see how Ngannou would negate his way into range to be able to land a punch on Fury, who's known to be really awkward, and he did it with ease.
Well, you saying that, then, you know, Tyson Fury is this unpredictable character. You know, he sets the traps, faints all the time, and he's very unpredictable, quite hard to get to. Anthony Joshua's not that guy. So if Ngannou can get to Fury, that would then say that at some point, Joshua's going to have to trade with Ngannou as well.
At some point, yeah. I've looked at that fight and there's so many scenarios. And if you could pick a coach for Joshua for this fight, it would be that of Ben Davison. Okay. Very calculated coach. Not a risk-taking coach. Safety first. And I believe, I really truly believe, and it is I've looked at it so many ways to how Joshua would approach this fight. And I believe he'll box on his back foot initially and try and pick off Ngannou. And should he at any point hurt him, then he'll move into range and conclude the fight. That's how I see it. That is the only way I believe he can fight this fight. He wouldn't dare. And I don't think Ben's not like that. He's more. He's a very, like I said, very meticulous in the way he approaches fights, game plans. And I believe that's the strategy they will use is try and sting him, sting it. Go back to the amateur days, the tactics that won Joshua the Olympic gold. He has to
refer
back to the amateur style in and out. And should you, like I said, which has got plenty of shots to hurt Ngannou, and then if he sees any signs, then should he go in and inflict more pain on Ngannou?
Yeah, I mean, Dan Hardy, the other side of the break there, Simon, former welterweight MMA fighter, made a great case for Ngannou. And I tuned in and I listened very carefully to what he said there. Everything changes if Ngannou can start getting through Joshua's guard.
Yeah. I mean, he would say that. It's a PFL fighter. It's one of his fighters. So he's going to be in the camp of Ngannou. I mean, if Anthony Joshua goes in and does his job, then ultimately this should not be a difficult fight for him. If he wants to make it difficult for himself by getting into situations where he highlights Ngannou's strengths, then he'll make it difficult for himself. I wanted to ask Don about the billing of knockout chaos. Do you expect, as a result of this fight, that we're going to see a knockout? You've got two guys that hit very hard. But we're talking about Anthony Joshua using and engaging his brain to box him at distance and take opportunities when they come, which may not come. He may box him out, you know, at length and just win it on an easy points victory. But do you expect to see someone get knocked out in this fight?
The percentages are high of a knockout when you've got these two guys. And knowing Anthony, his mentality, how I know him, if the fight's going well for him, he will go look for that knockout. And then Ngannou, the only way he's going to win this fight is by knocking Anthony Joshua out. And so that's why the percentages are high in there being a knockout in this fight.
But given what you know about the strategic thinking of Ben Davison and given what we know potentially about some of the limitations of Ngannou, do you ultimately expect to see a knockout? If you were putting a bet down, would you bet on a knockout?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know what? This is what makes this fight so fascinating, though, that if Anthony Joshua gets too greedy and he sits there too long, he gets, you know, and gets clipped, then the fight changes around very, very quickly. So you have to give Ngannou that respect. That's what makes the fight intriguing.
Yeah. I don't know which way to go now. After listening to Dan Hardy and now listening to you, Don, but I suppose this is why they're staging a fight like this.
Absolutely.
To such a large extent, we're all into the unknown again, aren't we?
Absolutely. And look,
nobody thought Ngannou would put Fury in the seat of his pants.
Exactly. I mean, look where we are. Initially, when he was going to fight Fury, Ngannou, it was being billed as, or talked about, it's a gimmick fight.
Right, exactly.
Right. No one's saying that now.
No.
With Anthony Joshua. We're this is a serious fight.
Yeah. We're taking him seriously.
So the industry have recognised, embraced Ngannou, and we're talking about him seriously. So,
but is it not a testament, a slightly pointed question, to how good these heavyweight champions are? Because, you know, you've got the elite heavyweight champions that have got, with respect, yes, he can fight. We know he can fight because of the sport that he's in. But he's not fought, you know, boxing fights, in a competitive fashion. He's not fought for 18 months. He's had a knee rebuild. And he goes and makes the generational great heavyweight, Tyson Fury, look pretty average. And now we're talking about him potentially giving Anthony, what does this say about the elite heavyweights in our division right now?
Well, I don't think it could, when I said discredit Ngannou's efforts. You know, in life, you know, it's almost like, I'll give you a football analogy, for instance. I won't bore you. You get a second division side gets drawn against a premiership side in the FA Cup.
Yeah.
Yeah. That second division side will give the premiership usually they do, a nightmare, torrid time, right? Then you think, excuse me, why don't you play like that every week? You won't be in the second division. So in Ghana, if you look at it like that, if you get a top 15 heavyweight, for instance, and put him up against in Ghana, who's to say he'll be up for it? He's been put on a stage where the whole world is watching him. So this is, it's almost like a performance of a lifetime. He's going to have to do it twice.
What would you expect Daniel Dubois to do to someone like Ngannou?
Like Ngannou. Exactly what, I'm not a hypocrite, exactly the same approach I would use on him. I believe he's going to come on to Joshua, and I believe he'll come on to Daniel, just like Baby Miller did. You got to sting him on the way in, hurt him, then look to put him on his back foot. Depending on how the fight is going, you look to put him on their back foot.
But if you look back on that fight against Tyson Fury, right, and there's a lot of talk about Fury and his preparations and he's underperforming, etc. But you look at Francis Ngannou and break Francis Ngannou down, the guy can fight. He boxes orthodox southpaw. Actually, what he lacks in speed, he made up for in timing. He punched when Fury punched. He outfought the guy that is known as the best boxing IQ in the game today. So I think that it's taking a lot of credit away. I know that he's the first fight.
I'm not taking any credit away from Ngannou. I'm saying the credit away from the heavyweights. As good as we crack them up to be,
perhaps Ngannou might just be as good as the good heavyweights of today.
No,
there's that argument.
Trust me, the heavyweights, the crop of heavyweights we have currently around the world, they are very, very good. It's just you've got one individual.
You lot make me die. You sit there talking about, if he hasn't had a back catalogue of amateur fights and he's not good enough to be in this.
Now, Who said that?
You all do.
No, this is a one-off. There is such a thing.
A significant position, but don't forget, he's not had an enormous amount of experience because he's done amateur fights. Now you're making a case for a guy that's had no fights in the professional boxing world to be a world beater. And you're refusing to accept that maybe the top 10 heavyweight fights.
He's a phenomenon.
Ain't that great?
He's a one off. How many Ngannous? Okay. He's a one off. I guarantee you that he's a one off, and no one's ever done it. This is the first time in the history of the sport that I believe this is.
Don, before we hit the break, let me ask you this, and you can keep it short. Does Joshua knock Ngannou out tomorrow?
Most definitely. If you ask me, I don't bet, but if I was to put a pound on it, I will put my pound on Joshua.
To knock him out.
Most definitely. He's a human being and he breathes oxygen.
But again, as Simon said, we thought Fury would do that.
We did, but he was an unknown at the time, Ngannou.
Okay. Joshua's a more concussive puncher than Fury, by the way, as well.
The world's most dangerous download. Outspoken with White and Jordan. From the world's biggest sports radio station, Talk Sport.
Thanks for listening to Outspoken with White and Jordan. Please leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast from. We're back tomorrow to bring you the best of the show.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.